Right, Ocasio Cortez is all style and no substance. Hello and welcome to the Poorly Informed Podcast. Great to have you with us. It's our 24th episode today. It's a big episode. And on top of that, we estimate we will have reached 1,000 listens by the time of this podcast, which is awesome. We never expected to quite get this, but we're not going to be focused on that. We're going to get into the topic, which is the second part of our loose two-parter. Last week, we looked at the political spectrum. We looked at what politics is. We looked at communism. We looked at socialism and capitalism and the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. This week, we're developing that and we're going for a full-fledged debate. Capitalism versus socialism. Which economic system does better for the people? There's a lot of emotion in this debate. There's a lot of stakes. We've been pushing and angling towards this from episode one. If you listen to some of our episodes, we hinted it quite a lot. But this is the first time we've explored it fully in what is, I'm sure, to be a quite intense argument. With me are Will, Peter and Max. We're doing capitalism versus socialism. Welcome to the Poorly Informed Podcast. So, each of you, give me, what is your view? What is your thought on the preferable economic system? So, Max.
Yes, I'm more on the side of capitalism. So, not, you know, not unrestricted capitalism, but sort of middle capitalism, because that's where I like to be, in the middle. So, as in, basically, I think capitalism is better for the majority of people because it leads to more economic and technological development, which in the long run and short run will be better for the majority of people.
Okay, so not laissez-faire capitalism, which we saw in the 1800s, but sort of capitalism where the government occasionally gets involved and helps to stop the worst excesses.
Yeah, low-level regulation.
Low-level regulation. Okay, Will, in a very fetching black T-shirt.
Should be red.
Yeah, it should
be red.
Well,
it should be red and black, actually, to be specific. No, I would go for a more socialist society. However, I'm not in favour of the USSR-style planned economy, because that's a bad thing. And I'll probably go into more detail, because I can't monologue here, about the kind of socialist economy I'd be in favour of.
Okay. So the fact you've even talked about a Soviet economy shows you're a pretty hard socialist.
Yes, yeah, I would describe myself as, I mean, this is the kind of the system that I think would be best for individuals. Whether it's actually possible to implement it in our lifetimes, no idea.
I mean, but that's moot, isn't it?
Yeah, but in terms of what would be ideal for humanity if we could possibly do it, yeah, this is what I think would be the best option.
Okay, and Peter?
I'm sort of a watered down version of Will. I would say that there's a slightly socialist leaning economic system offers protections for workers and people, as well as allows for some of the benefits that a free market undoubtedly brings.
Okay.
What about yourself, Theo?
So I'm, as always, the host is famously neutral on this podcast, but as it is a 2v1 situation with Will and Peter versus Max, I'll probably weigh in on Max's side a little bit. So Max, do you want to start? What is the biggest, why are you so convinced that capitalism is good? And more to the point, why is socialism not good?
So, I think capitalism is better because I'm going to start with, you know, the good old one of it rewards people for entrepreneurship. So, people are more likely to want to strive to make technological advancements, work harder if they think they can get more out of it. If you've got a very socialist society, the benefits from working harder are lesser, which will generally decrease motivation and progress. I don't do monologues.
So I just don't know what to expect.
Yeah, I was expecting more of a time to prepare a response.
Right, so what is your response?
Quick and snappy.
Think of how many CEOs, and then I don't actually have a number on this, but I would guess.
Well researched.
Oh yes, absolutely. I managed to
three pages
most
of research,
things, but not this.
And your opening point is got no data.
Just to think about it though,
I how many to avoid all the places that he's actually researched.
How many CEOs came from a poor background where they had nothing and literally pulled themselves up by their bootstraps?
Andrew Carnegie, head of Carnegie Steel, the richest man in the 1800s. John D. Rockefeller, who inherited a tiny oil business from his dad.
A tiny oil business.
It was, look, he made it into Standard Oil, the biggest company
but
in the world.
And if you inherit an oil business, you can't say you came from...
Yeah, but at the time, petroleum wasn't used for fuel. And it was a smelly gas for lamps.
For every one of those, how many people do you reckon, say, didn't become that? Who worked just as hard and then didn't become the head of an oil or gas company?
Your point stands.
It's in the millions kind of territory. It's one of those things where, yes, if you get lucky, have the right timing... And, you know, everything goes well for you. You can be rock bottom poor, you could be homeless and become a CEO. That is technically possible. Whether that's actually happened in, say, the last 100 years, I would really quite doubt it. It's almost impossible. The nature of capitalism means capital is needed to make more capital. That's the fundamental. The system is skewed so that the more money you have, the easier it is to make money. What happens with the capitalist class is they own the so-called means of production, which is... everyone's favourite phrase on this podcast. Basically, it means, for anyone who doesn't know, is like if you own the means of production, you own the factories, you own the tools, you own...
And it's a phrase popularised by Karl Marx, who developed communism as a coherent ideology.
Indeed. And essentially, if the capitalists own the factories, then it doesn't matter how hard the workers work, they're not going to get any more of that. They might get paid a little bit more, but they're not going to be able to own it.
So let's cut. So what you're saying is capitalism doesn't do... So it might motivate a few individual people, but it doesn't do anything for everyone.
It doesn't reward hard work.
However, you took that to the extreme by saying homeless people becoming CEOs. I know that was an extreme example on purpose, but I don't think... It's more as in middle class become... more wealthy, or middle class develops. And you were saying that your last point about how workers, the only benefit they receive is higher wages, which is true. They get higher wages because of general economic development, because the people at the top are striving to work harder. So although individuals may not benefit from it, society as a whole does. The average wage rate increases, standard of living increases. Because the problem is, at the start, you said not going to talk about the USSR, which makes it really hard to make any proper comparisons towards quality and standards of life, because that's the only one I really know.
I think you can't say that workers, like middle class people, benefit that much in a completely capitalist society either, because you still, I think, only 0.5% of people own 90% of the stocks and shares in the UK. So you can't say the middle class is booming and benefiting from all of this like wealth that is being brought in, all the development and wages being brought in from a free market, because they're clearly not. It's clearly only the richest people who can afford to buy stocks, which then afford to accumulate more wealth.
I'm more talking about sort of the general advancements in the economy. The economy is likely to do better under a free market. It may not be morally the best, because you'll have expectations.
The
numbers will be bigger, which will be better for most people.
But it will only really benefit the people who own stock, which are the 0.1%.
The people at the top will benefit a lot more than the people in the middle and the bottom. The people in the middle and the bottom will still benefit.
It's rising inequality.
Rising inequality if everyone is still doing better. If no one is starving, if everyone has a good quality of life, I don't care if someone has a bathroom made of solid diamonds, right? That's all right. You know, it's not good. However, if everyone else is living a good life, there's very...
But Max, there are a lot of starving people in the USA, which is one of the most capitalist-orientated economies in the world, okay? In that case, there are a lot of people starving. Therefore, you do care. Therefore, that suggests capitalism isn't working.
And I mean, if we...
Is this the religion debate? Are you getting back at me for the religion debate?
No, this is...
I will give you that. However, Soviet Russia. Lots more people died there. Communism bad.
Yes, I can agree.
That's how I get back to every point at the end of this.
Soviet Russia is bad. Can't disagree with you on that one. Soviet Russia was what is called a planned or a command economy. Well, they're two slightly different terms. They mean slightly different things. But basically, it was where the guy at the top, the dictator, Joseph Stalin in this case to begin with, basically gives orders and people obey those orders, and that's how the economy functions. I don't think that's a particularly good way of handling an economy, because it relies on a single person for pretty much everything, and it means there's this massive bureaucracy, it's inefficient, He was also a massive dictator who, I don't know, murdered people, which is never a good thing for a society. So yeah, I can say what you want about the USSR. I'm generally not going to disagree with you. I mean, there are finer points on how bad was it actually, and you could probably disagree over those. However, I think we can all pretty much come to the consensus that USSR bad.
Yeah.
So should we remove the USSR as an example from this debate? Because it's not going to do anyone any favours.
Oh, no.
Okay, well, thank you, Theo.
That is a great idea.
I have something else to say. That in terms of finding countries to compare us to, it's very hard to compare a capitalist country to a socialist country, because there aren't very many Western socialist nations, like as in heavily socialist nations. Like obviously there's like France and sort of, you know, slightly socialist, debatable depending on who you ask. But there's very few countries which are actually full scale socialism to be able to look at as a case study. However, there are lots of capitalist countries to easily say, oh, that's a problem in that country, that's a problem in this country. Because where's lots of socialist countries? Asia, for example. Asia generally lower standard of living, lower income and everything. But is that because it's socialist or not? It's, I don't know.
Where would it be socialist in Asia? I'm just wondering.
Bangladesh,
Vietnam.
China, Vietnam.
Vietnam and Laos, one of the few communist states left in the world.
Yeah, I'm not saying socialist, not communist.
Nepal's still got a communist party in charge.
Yep.
Nepal, well, no, they were elected in recently, actually.
They keep winning elections. But they do occasionally lose elections, so it's interesting.
Do they let go of power when they lose the elections?
Kind of.
Kind of.
It's not the most democratic place.
Now, okay, let's move on to, while we're in the Asian neighbourhood, let's move on to China.
Okay,
China, which set up as, but you know, of the three of you, some of you must have instantly have thoughts about China as a socialist and capitalist country and the beneficiaries of each system. Does anyone want to come in on that?
China is not good. Why are they so scared of foreign influence? The whole thing is that they don't want foreign influence. They don't want Western influence. Like Xi Jinping said the other week, I think, that they should teach. They should teach toddlers to support the Communist Party in school, and so that they don't get influenced by wrong ideals, Western ideals. So why is China so worried about Western ideals and the idea of capitalism going to their country if socialism is so good and works so well for everyone?
There are more billionaires in China than anywhere else in the world.
People in China than anywhere else in the world.
But China's not a communist nation, it's state capitalist.
It's not been communist since before Deng Xiaoping, is it?
Xiaoping,
yeah.
No, Deng Xiaoping.
So it's not...
Yeah, I'm not saying they're communist.
I will admit, though, that China being not communist has been a massive improvement for the people of China.
Yeah, well, every country
which has
gone from communist...
Teaching broken ranks.
Well, go on, because what's happened with China is we've had a nation that is essentially... It was very rural, agricultural, industry wasn't fantastic. It goes through this very sort of tumultuous stage of becoming industrialised. People starve, there's famines, it's mismanaged. But then you emerges from this... in like industrial superpower. And if I think if we say when we look at like China and the USSR, yes, these periods where they go from agricultural societies to industry-based societies, generally loads of people died. But if you also look at in our own history, this we're probably not too far off the similar death tolls if you look over the, because we just took a lot more time to go from an agricultural society to an industrial society. It takes us 300 years. They were sort of forced to do it by their leaders in like 20 or 30. It's not surprising that the death tolls are horrendous as they are.
All I'm hearing is that there always seems to be an excuse as to why socialism
doesn't work. I'm not excusing that. That's just a rapid...
Capitalism does work, and most Western nations practice it, and it does work, and it leads to an effective form of government.
Well, it leads to a form of government that is very good for the rich, is not so good for the poor, where workers' rights...
Like, it's not...
Let the man finish.
We think of, what do we enjoy these
concentration
days?
Concentration camps, like in China.
Stop!
What do we enjoy these days? Well, I like weekends. I like 40-hour work weeks. I like 40-hour work weeks. I like minimum wages. I like not starving to death on the streets.
Good.
These were essentially fought with, like, literal blood. People died for these rights, in both here and in the US, all across Europe. The trade union movement was a very important movement, and without it, we would all be working 80 hours a week with no weekends, and being paid for.
But was trade union socialist, or did socialism infect the trade unions?
Trade unionism, as its at its core, is something that is pro worker rights, and on a fundamental level, that is very, very similar to socialism. You can't really separate the two, and it is like the Labour Party has a red flag for a reason. It's because of it's representing the sacrifices that workers made, where they often these were often violent things. They had running battles with police. There was an instance in the 1920s in America where a company literally paid, I can't remember if it was their own private air force or if it was the US Air Force, to bomb striking miners. Like, people were getting killed, there were massacres, like hundreds of people die in these situations. So, I mean, and it's all been against this capitalist class. This is not because capitalism is generous and lets people do this, it's because it's been fought tooth and nail against to prevent capitalism from screwing people over this badly.
What you're saying about how workers' rights are inherently a socialist idea, and they are, but I'm not arguing unbridled capitalism, I'm not arguing laissez-faire. I still think there should be some regulation, and I still think that... I still think there should be some regulation, I still think we should keep all those rights which have been argued for. And that is what capitalism is at the moment. Like, we are a capitalist country, we're more capitalist than socialist, and we have all those rights. So as America, they have those rights. Europe, most of Europe, they have those rights as well. Just because you are a communist nation... Just because you're a capitalist nation doesn't mean you cannot have workers' rights. They are not inherently separate things, because better workers' rights generally leads to more productivity and more economic growth. So it's a sacrifice which companies make for the future purpose of more profits.
Well, companies don't make this sacrifice. They were forced to make the sacrifice. There's an important distinction that workers' rights were won by the working class. They weren't given to them.
There's the idea of welfare capitalism in the 1920s, wasn't it?
Yeah, around 1920s,
1920s. Where they experienced good economic growth. Companies didn't want workers to unionise, so they gave them more rights. They gave them higher wages, shorter working weeks, so that they wouldn't strike, so they could make more profits. It wasn't out of some socialist thing. It was purely to make more profit out of a capitalistic drive. And now that those rights have been...
What we're saying there is that the company is acting in their own self-interest by acting in advance to stop the workers bettering themselves, better the workers to a lesser degree so the workers wouldn't improve their situation more. Capitalism is all about the less... If a company can get away with paying workers less without suffering other downsides, they will.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that. If there wasn't a minimum wage, companies would try paying less where they could.
Mm-hmm.
If it meant people leave to go and work elsewhere, they wouldn't. But if they can, if it's, I don't know, a cleaner who is willing to work for 20p less, they will pay them 20p less. The economics are fairly simple.
Yeah, true.
That is not a good thing. We shouldn't be living in a society where... every single major enterprise is focused around trying to reduce and downsize and ultimately make the human worth less if they can. And that's where capitalism kind of gets it a bit backwards, in my opinion. So I was looking at this, because I know how you're saying, oh, there's no proper socialist states you can really compare it to capitalism. So I was thinking, yeah, that's a good point, what can I compare it to? Then I realised there's a fundamental... way of how businesses work rather than how countries work, and some businesses work a bit different to others, and I'm sure you've actually all heard of them. This is cooperatives. So this is a business which, in my opinion, it should be and is probably one of the best model ways to look at a business, in my opinion, what everything should be. This is where the workers own the business. The business is not owned by an external source. Those who work for it own it. And alternatives to this, you can have consumers owning the business as well. And now if you look at... cooperatives, as they're called, 12% of all humans are actually involved in one, which is about 900 million people. They're not small. These things work on large scales. There's a Spanish one that's the fourth largest industrial group in Spain. They've got 74,000 employees across their different branches. And generally, they pay their workers more. They don't... their higher-ups are paid less. Their workers are paid more. They have very good... things like rights in work, they're generally happier, they're generally more productive. And that is what I think a socialist economy, in my opinion, should focus around. It's democratic control of the workplace. Now, sorry to go on a massive tangent here, you can have your response in a second, but if we look at the USSR, they had the government controlled the economy, and the people supposedly controlled the government. the where that broke down, that was meaning that the people control the economy. Where that broke down was the people didn't control the government. However, if the people control their workplaces directly, if workers have a say in how their workplaces are run because they own their workplaces, that fundamentally gives the workers, they own the means of production. That is a fundamentally a good idea, and I have more evidence, but I'll let you respond to that.
I'm going to have to get a notebook or something so I can just write down the points I want to make.
I only used 4 bullet points. I need to get my other 150.
Oh, no. Okay, right, so what you're saying is basically socialism worked. You pointed out socialism in, you know, socialist aspects in Spain, which is a capitalist country. You pointed out socialist aspects in the USSR, which was a socialist communist country. Okay, we can talk about the NHS, which is a socialist institution within a capitalist economy. The pattern we're seeing here is that socialism works within capitalist economies.
Yeah.
Can we not say that absolute poverty has halved since the 1990s? Internet usage has gone up, more people have gone to schools as the world has developed and become more capitalist, not less, as countries like China have become more capitalist, not less.
In the I'm all for greater, like, you know, more socialist sort of ideas, but I still think the overall focus should be on capitalism and a free market so that people can do what they want.
Child poverty in the UK in the last year has increased 200,000 by 200,000 people.
In the last year.
The amount of people living in, the amount of children in poverty, in absolute poverty, has increased by 200,000. I heard on the radio yesterday in the car from the Office of National
Statistics
or Bureau of Work and Pensions or something. That's bad. The UK is...
Do you mean relative poverty, not absolute?
This is absolute poverty. Not relative poverty.
We have we had a UN special.
The
distinction is absolute poverty is when you're living on below $2 a day.
When you can't afford the basic needs to survive.
Effectively, so in the UK it'd be more than $2 a day. Relative poverty is when you are earning under 60% the median income.
Yeah.
So in the UK that's about $20,000 a year, give or take. So I mean that is a huge statistic.
And what's been causing this? Well, if we look at the current government, Tory government in power, austerity, right? Why was austerity need to be implemented?
The recession.
Yes, exactly. No. The recession caused it.
What's that?
No.
Thank
you, Max.
That's what I get for being on my phone.
And recessions are sort of, well, very much an integral part of capitalism.
He's not
going to
shut
up
now.
You can't separate recessions and capitalism. They come together. They are very much the same thing in that regard. If we look at cooperatives during the 2008 recession, these are cooperative banks. These are large institutions. They fared a lot better than traditional investment banks. They were somewhere in the region of about 5 times less likely to fail in 2010. They had a failure rate of somewhere around 0.4% as opposed to the 1.8% of an investment bank. These are institutions that are less risky in what they do. They don't gamble away money in these big market games across the world. And they are less likely to be needed to be bailed out. They are less likely to cost the taxpayer money. And they're more likely to continue lending. These are businesses that were able to continue lending. And in fact, during I think it's between 2010 and 2014, they actually doubled their lending to small businesses from 30 billion to 60 billion worldwide, whereas overall lending reduced by about 100 billion across the world.
But before, we see that was a crisis of capitalism, and that's caused a lot of shockwaves in the decade since, where we see people almost revolting against capitalist ideals. But before the recession, wasn't it a Labour government that said, we've ended boom and bust?
Yes, it was. And this Labour government, in my opinion, was one of the worst. I do not like Tony Blair. I'm not a fan of Tony Blair. I'm not going to make that I'm not going to hide that. He is neoliberal, and I don't think neoliberals have a particular
place
in there.
What's a neoliberal?
Neoliberalism is it's a school of economic thought that is pro-free market, wants to reduce regulation. They are classical capitalists, basically. But often, someone like Tony Blair would have an emphasis on the welfare state alongside reducing regulation in the main industries.
Right.
I mean, one of the acts that was
so
mainly...
you don't like Tony Blair because under his leadership we saw sustained economic growth?
Under his leadership...
Or building of schools and hospitals around the country.
Under his leadership, we reduced regulation on the in financial industries that contributed. I'm not going to say overall, because there's obviously other reasons. America was a big reason.
Mainly was America.
But
America
was also had... Bill Clinton had signed an act that basically separated investments and saving banks. Well, there was a separation between them. He signed an act that got rid of that.
Wasn't it Republican-controlled Congress that pushed that through?
He also was fine with, he did not.
If he'd used a veto against it, then he would have been in trouble, and he'd already had one impeachment procedure in his presidency.
Yes, at the same time, the Democrats on the left of the Americans are neoliberals. Like, that is something that they are all for, especially in that time.
Right.
And, yes, and also if you look at the building schools, building hospitals, yes, we built loads, and the PFIs, which were these private contracts we made for them, are now costing the taxpayer far more than it would have cost to just own them publicly.
But was that because private institutions built them, didn't that mean they have higher quality?
Not necessarily.
Public built buildings are never that good. Public run services are never that good.
You Reading buses even
with the best in the country.
Best in the country, council owned, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a council owned.
There you go.
Business.
I like Reading buses. Max, you like Reading buses?
Southwest Trains. No, hold on, I've confused myself. Sorry, you're talking about Reading buses.
Yeah, council owned, and they work better than any other bus system in the country. I think that's all we have. That's clearly
therefore socialism is the top economic system.
Therefore, nationalisation of everything is clearly the way forward.
Yes, dear listener.
Just to be owned by the Reading Council.
Yes, dear listener, we do live in Reading. But then compare that to the nationalised rail system in the 1970s.
What's a rail system?
Rail system. A nationalised railway system in the 1970s, one of the most decrepit railways in Western Europe, if
and
not
we still have
world.
One of the most decrepit railways.
Is not that good, and prices have been skyrocketing.
I've traveled,
however, is due to, partially due to, afterwards, I haven't said anything in a while, I need to make Will.
Okay, fine.
Wipe that smile off his face, he's so smug. Lots of the reasons for the train prices rising so much has been because of union action. So the unions have been, who was it who said this? I need to find the article.
So, train ticket prices tend to rise with inflation, plus a little bit of profit allowed on top of that. So, and also, I clocked up around 1,000 miles this month, travelling to universities, much of that on trains, not one single hitch. I've been up to the northeast of the country, northwest of the country, no delays, no cancellations, no waiting whatsoever. I went up to York. No delays, no cancellations. And that was going to London first. Most of the railway system in this country is pretty damn good.
It's only the most expensive in Europe.
Yeah, because Europe can benefit from economies of scale, where the entire continent's interlinked railways cost can
but
lower
often
across
the
entire system.
Companies that run the railways are state-owned. Like the French own part of our... I think they own...
Yeah, and it's inefficient. Inefficient and bureaucratic, and Macron's trying to spin it off.
Do you know what the starting salary for a tube driver is?
£35,000 a year or something.
55,000.
Right.
That's more than teachers. That's more than.
It's more than
of
any
of
us are
going to
earn until
what?
We're 50.
Not... Good for them, Max.
No, it's not. Do you want to know why they earn so much? Because they have such strong power in London. Because they can just, if they strike, London loses millions and billions. And
so are you saying that they're doing a very important job, and that if they stop doing their job, they're going to really cause problems for the city?
Should they get paid more than doctors just because they have a more
important
role? So can
strong-arm
the government just because they have that power? No.
They're worth being paid that much.
No, they're not. It's not a hard
job.
The day when tube drivers get replaced by computers, I'm going to be celebrating in the streets.
It may not be... a difficult job, but it's such an important job that it warrants this level of pay.
If your job keeps the London running, you should be paid a lot. That is an important job. You need to be able to do it correctly, and you can't fuck up. Sorry, you can't screw up. If you're not getting paid enough, or if you're unhappy about working conditions, and you say, I don't know, you cause a crash. That is not just killing people, but that's causing economic problems in London because people can't move around.
Okay.
Very important.
Water break.
So, the whole thing with the tube drivers' salaries and price of trains is because it's linked to RPI, which is the retail price index, and the inflation on the RPI. Do you want to know what one of the main reasons for the increase in costs to produce for the train people is? Train drivers and train workers who are protesting, who are striking because they have so much sway that they can get paid, what was it, the highest tube driver get paid over 100 grand last year. Which isn't, that shouldn't be done. They should get paid less. Do you know where that money could go? Could go into welfare.
How much do airline pilots get paid?
About 50 grand, the same.
It's similar
to... It's much harder to fly a train than to drive a...
Fly a train. Yes, I mean, if you could fly a train, I would be impressed. But no, if you think, they're both performing the role of transport, right?
True.
At the end of the day, one's international, one's more national, unless you're in Europe. Yeah.
One's flying through the air, has to make actual adjustments, one has to say, speed up, slow
down.
I just
realised, you guys are arguing in favour of the opposite point. You're saying
everyone
should be paid fairly on basis of their merit, not like just their economic position. And you're saying no, if they've earned it, they should keep it.
No.
You're saying, Will's saying capitalist wages are fine. Mac is saying socialist.
I'm saying less workers' rights.
Whereas I'm saying that if they have this value to a city like London, where they are indispensable, then it is right that they get paid more.
Okay.
Okay. Can we go back to some of the banking stuff?
Because yes,
this is the big macro
stuff.
No, it's
where we're doing the most research. I don't want to be here.
This is where the big macro stuff happens. Because if we're arguing over, I don't know, the prices of a 50 grand wage as opposed to a 30 grand wage, that's, at the end of the day, isn't a load of money. But if we look at, say, I don't know, there's something called a credit union in banking, which is essentially where it's sort of a bank that's owned by the people who... or work there, but also who use the bank, so it's not just workers. And it's this, and it can be democratically controlled. They vary in the levels of this. But if we look at their response to the 2008 financial crisis, which was a disaster in all terms, like this was a very bad year for everyone. It meant austerity had to be implemented in this country, or people thought it had to be implemented. Let's not go into that just yet.
Would have balanced the budget by 2020. That's all I'm saying.
Brexit said ripped.
Let's get on with it.
But if you look at credit unions, for instance, they actually did pretty well. Like they in 2007, credit unions had about 1,180 million US dollars in assets. In 2011, they had 1,500. Like these unions are benefiting they're not benefiting from the recession, but they're not really being sunk by it. They're less likely to be, as I said earlier, they're less likely to fail, they're less likely to require taxpayer bailout. In the Netherlands, the biggest bank was the only one that didn't need to be bailed out. And basically what this is, well, the point I'm getting to, in the roundabout way that I do, is that when workers have a direct stake, when they have ownership and control over where they work, they are more likely to make rational decisions than the equivalent investor or owner. They are generally slightly more conservative about things. They don't make stupid risks, and that results in a generally less up and down, all over the place economy, and benefits everyone.
I'll give you that. Maybe more stable. However, the thing you said about being democratically controlled and how workers are more likely to make better decisions—is that what you were saying?
Yes, that is something that from this is essentially true. Like,
however, if you've got a company which is being run by multiple people, it's going to have much. It's got a less united drive. There's not a cohesive strategy at the top because you have lots of different viewpoints. This whole problem when companies merge is that it's two different viewpoints and they may not align for the future, which is why mergers fail. But if you have a company which has lots of different viewpoints being controlled by loads of different people, it's basically a problem with democracy is how you have so many people with different opinions that overall it's much more inefficient output. And these companies, I'm going to assume, are probably less efficient than a privately owned company.
So,
although they may fail less often, they are still much less efficient.
So the efficiency for cooperative banks as opposed to investment banks, the efficiency of cost-to-income ratio of a cooperative bank is 62%. It's 61% for investor-owned banks. There is essentially no difference in efficiency.
What's cooperative bank and an investment bank? Do cooperative banks invest or are they on savings?
So cooperative banks can have investment arms.
Because they are two completely different industries.
Yes.
So it's like saying...
So cooperative banks are like building societies. Like
yes,
nationwide.
But they can have investment arms. They
so
can
you
do
should
both
compare
roles.
Cooperative banks
no,
to
no, you
can, retail
you
banks?
No, you can kind of compare the two.
Yes, you can, but saying that...
Well, no, this isn't investor banks. This is investor-owned banks.
So Barclays.
Two different things.
So
yes,
you say Barclays. So, and then you've got investment banks like Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, where you wouldn't put your money... But
they invest in things. Yeah, no, these are investor-owned banks.
Okay.
Right.
So the, obviously the key difference is, so investor-owned banks are more invested in investment, right? Whereas the building societies are basically just trying to give you interest so that you put money in their bank. So their investment is much more limited. Okay. Do we reckon as a whole that investment by banks is good for the economy? So let's say as a moot point, we want economic growth.
Yeah, because
economic
savings,
growth is economic,
yeah,
economic right. growth broadly benefits people and it encourages job creation and collection of higher incomes and better standards of living. Okay, should we rest on that premise?
Also, because savings are bad for economic growth.
So if we look at credit
savings
unions...
Savings are necessary for loans to be given out for economic growth to take place. Banks can't give out loans unless people are saving in them.
However, don't our model 4.5 on the economics A-level ed Excel specification?
Like, however, no, because it doesn't matter if there's high savings if the banks are giving the money back to the people.
No,
if the, because no, because cooperative banks have a lower capital to liability rate, whichever the ratio, which means the money they have compared to the money they lend. Cooperative banks will have a much closer ratio where they won't lend as much, which means they'll make less loans. So it's less money creation, less loans being given out, less increase in efficiency and less economic growth.
So if we look at 2008, credit unions increased their, they actually doubled their worldwide lending to small businesses from 30 billion to 60 billion. I think I've already said this. Whereas overall lending actually declined by 100 billion. We are looking at places like, okay, they might not be investing as much, but that is because they're also a smaller part of the sector. The majority of all these sectors are still generally investor-owned. But they actually do, they sort of, when times are tough, cooperative banks can actually then go and loan more than an investor bank. So they are putting more back into the economy and producing growth in tougher times where people are going to be suffering.
And also, you want banks to not fail if an economic crash happens.
That's true, but a bank did do a pretty damn good job of investing for 70 years before the recession.
That was, a lot of that's to do with the way the policies went into, again, neoliberalism. Because before neoliberalism was a school of thought called Keynesianism. I can never say that. Which was far more capitalism with socialist leanings. Which was a lot of the reasons in my opinion, it reduced the
banks also were investing because that's part of the capitalist model. They want to make money. Therefore, that did undeniably drive growth.
Yeah, but there were restrictions on how...
socialist.
No, I'm not saying socialist.
You spend money to make money, which is capitalist, because the more money you have, the more...
Well, it's pushing public...
Yeah,
money. It's government, public spending.
More government spending, but on investment.
It is still capitalist with socialist elements.
It's more of a, that would be maybe, sorry Peter, it's more of like a state intervention.
Labour would like it. Labour like Keynes, the Conservatives don't.
It would be state intervention in the economy where the state decides what to invest more in, which, I mean, is a step towards socialism, but it isn't socialism. No, they're not the same thing. Yeah.
I don't think you can argue that investment banks have benefited the economy.
Investment banks are different to investor banks.
Banks owned by investors.
Right.
Is that
so retail? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Retail have benefited the economy when they also crashed the global economy and put humanity back a decade.
They did, but that was due to poor regulation, not due to capitalism itself. If we had
It was no regulation is unrestrained capitalism.
Yeah, I'm not talking about unrestrained
capitalism.
More
government intervention
I'm talking about means
less capitalism.
And also, the world economy had done a very good job of bouncing back, and the world economy is primarily capitalist.
But it's been bouncing back on the back of cutting more regulation and being more business friendly, leading to what will soon be another recession, I believe, even bigger than the last one.
I think you're making stuff up now.
Well, no, because you can't slash interest rates. People don't have any savings.
If there's a recession, we'll be in trouble. But it's not going to come from. We don't know that it'll come from unbridled capitalism again. Okay.
Well, I mean, that's what essentially where recessions
where
come
recessions.
From.
Not
that's
always.
How recessions...
You can get stagflation, which is effectively when you have high unemployment, high inflation, everyone's keeping money in the bank. That's got nothing to do with capitalist ideals. That's just people panicking.
What's the, well, I mean, it's all that exists in a capitalist system. You can't. I don't.
So do socialist countries never have crises as well?
No, but when you're talking about a crisis in a capitalist society, that isn't something to do with capitalism. Like that can't, you can't transplant that to an entirely different kind of system.
Let's talk about economic stability in socialist nations. Have you heard of Venezuela?
I have.
He's got like 4 or 5 points on Venezuela. Yeah. I saw them. But I'm giving this to him.
So Venezuela is probably the most crisis-stricken country in the world right now.
Yeah.
So they barely have electricity. You've got raw sewage pumping into rivers and streams in the sea because they can't filter it. Maduro and a few cronies are hanging on to power while everyone else hates the government but doesn't have the power to overthrow them. You've got people who live... It's a middle-class affluent society which has been thrown into wretched poverty by President Maduro and his what he calls socialism, as well as the socialism of his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, Jeremy Corbyn admires.
These problems are fairly ingrained. I mean, this has been building up since the 1970s because they got very, very rich off of oil money. And what happens when someone gets very rich off of oil money? They don't spend it all. And then when the oil prices crash, they're suddenly out of a lot of money. So in the mid-1980s, they were massively in debt because they'd spent a load of money and oil prices had gone down. They decided that the solution to this was austerity and economic liberalisation in the 1990s. That caused a riot that killed somewhere around 2,000 people when government soldiers essentially had to invade a city. It's not been good for Venezuela. Venezuela was never on particularly stable footing. I don't like what Hugo Chavez and Maduro have done. I'm not condoning it. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I don't think it is. There's been mismanagement. There's been almost no curbing of corruption, even though that's what they were sort of elected to do in some ways. That's what they were saying they were doing. They weren't. They were getting rid of political opponents. I can't support Venezuela. I won't support Venezuela.
Okay.
I don't think it's...
So that is an example of where a socialist economy...
Well, it wasn't socialist... Venezuela isn't socialist in the sense of the workers own the means of the production. That's not the kind
socialism
of society...
Socialism's never been tried properly.
Well, socialism is the workers owning the means of production as a fundamental kind of... That's the barrier to socialism, right?
Well, my whole thing is that today we are discussing which one's the best. And if people keep arguing that socialism has never been tried properly, whenever you bring up an example of a socialist or similarly socialist or seemingly socialist state failing, then... How can it work as a proper state if the whole thing is, it doesn't matter if it's not, if in capitalism, yes, there are, some people can be very poor and people can be very rich, there's high wealth inequality, however, that is still better than a failing country. Even if it's bad, it's still better than not working at all.
Also, is the fact that socialism has never been tried before intrinsically linked to the fact that therefore it makes a less successful economic model compared to capitalism, which has been tried before and does to some extent work and pull off?
Who's been the most powerful continent in the world for the past 500 years?
Well,
Europe, right? Europe developed into a capitalist society kind of naturally. Like it was sort of a progression from feudalism to capitalism. It took a few hundred years, industrialization. It was never really going to the socialism route.
Listen to our episode several weeks ago where me, Max and Will talk about why Europe is the most powerful nation in history. Peter wasn't there because he pretended he was on holiday.
Indeed. So if we look at that, right, Europe was never really in danger of going anywhere other than capitalism. Like, from feudalism to capitalism, it's a natural progression from turning serfs into workers, right? That's how things go. Suddenly, we have the most powerful continent on Earth that has essentially all of the military power at this point. If we're looking at, like, the mid-1800s, they have essentially all the military power, they have all the economic power, they have all the resources, and they own most of the world. It's not really a surprise the system fundamentally opposed to the system that these countries are running doesn't get up and running. You look at any socialist, you say real or not, it doesn't... You look at any example of a socialist system that was said it was socialist, even if maybe some would argue it wasn't. They have intervention on all sides. The USSR was... The British landed an army in Russia. We were supporting the monarchists in Russia. We were actively fighting to destroy the USSR from the day it was formed.
You make that sound like it was a bad thing.
Yeah, they did.
No, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
They did execute lots of people. Like, you know, the royal family. They killed their dogs.
Yeah, I mean, both sides. If you also look...
That's my reason
dogs.
For this.
All right.
I hate communists.
Okay,
they killed the Romanovs. They killed their dogs.
Yes. But then also, actually, if you look at the Bolsheviks, they were going on pogroms against Jews, and so were the whites. Both sides were doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, neither side were particularly pleasant. But if you, and then if you look at revolutionary Spain in the 1930s, there were actually, this was an interesting situation where you had the nationalists and the republicans. The republicans were some socialists, some communists, and some anarchists. And in this situation, the anarchists actually had areas like Catalonia was run as an anarchist sort of state for a little while, even though there's anarchist state. There's more to it than that. But where workers basically controlled everything, it was run democratically by workers. And this was crushed by not only the nationalists supported by Hitler and the Nazis, but also by the Soviet Union that crushed other sorts of socialism. So there has never been an example of socialism where it's just been allowed to play out. There are always outside influences working very much against it. It's very much on the back foot the second it starts.
So it's a benefit of capitalism that no one wants to overthrow you, meaning it can work better as a government.
It's a better benefit of capitalism that capitalism owns the world's armies. Like, yes, the powerful people are powerful. That's how power politics works.
Capitalism allows for a military-industrial complex to exist.
Where do you go with that?
I'm not sure. Also, Albania doesn't have any McDonald's. Capitalism. Again, I'm not sure where I'm going with this.
Okay, well, Peter, with that non-point right there, I'm going to bring up the welfare word, the W word, and social welfare. Social welfare is good, correct?
Yes.
Too much welfare is bad. I'm going to go down.
Too much welfare makes people worse off. Because that's what we're arguing here.
It makes the country worse off. If you're paying too much welfare, the country is worse off.
We're talking about what's best for the people.
Yeah, but
more welfare is
better. But at the same time, we've not been talking about what's been best for the people for about half an hour.
Yeah, we're talking about economic growth.
So the government has less money, so they can't invest it into services to bring about economic growth, which benefits lots of people.
Couldn't the government just take out more loans to finance this economic growth and then still not let people starve in their streets? And still not increase food bank usage from 40,000 to 1.5 million.
Next, there'll always be a point. There will be a point where you cannot borrow any more money.
But we can borrow loads more money.
Yeah, or we can get rid of the deficit and continue to borrow and achieve greater economic growth.
We're the first generation to experience a lower standard of living than our parents, and that is unacceptable.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I was quite happy having a lower standard of living than my parents.
Standard of living should always improve. This should not be a thing that's controversial. Standard of living should improve for each subsequent generation. And it's not, mostly because many people are living in incredibly poor situations due to poor levels of wealth.
Hold on a minute. Are you saying the generation born just before the Great Depression didn't have a lower standard of living than their parents?
Every generation has had a higher standard of living than the group before. Lots of this to do with technology change. I'm not sure when the statistics start.
So we may have a slightly worse standard of living now, and but in the future, we might not.
I think you've got to consider the Great Recession was a massive. I mean, that.
Lots of people did starve to death.
Are you gonna, you're not going to let recession, me any depression. Point. The recession was a game changer. It shook up the entire world order to some degree. You can't have a near banking collapse and shrug it off. I think it's an inevitable impact that this generation is going to be worse off. You can't just blame that all on the Conservative government and their austerity policy.
There's a large recession every 10 years or so, isn't there? Or over 10?
The boom and bust cycle tends to be around 10 years.
This was undeniably the biggest recession since the Great Depression.
But
nothing else compares to it.
It was a big recession. Other generations have experienced recessions. I'll give you a point that
not on that size
will have hurt. But
the issue is, when we have a big recession, do we necessarily need to have a downturn in living standards? And no. That is, I think, where the two sides come to heads.
Well, yeah, I mean, every recession causes a downturn in living standards.
But
and then
why
it goes
should
back
it?
Up when the economy grows again.
Because
that's what economic downturn is. It's a downturn in the economy. People lose jobs, therefore people have less income, therefore they can spend less money, therefore they have lower standards of living. That is a priori. This point, economic growth means less income, which means lower standard of living.
But when economic growth doesn't lead to a, like, we've already spoken about the vastly differences in economic growth benefiting one portion of society, and it's like the whole thing, we bail out banks when they're too big to fail, because if they fail, it's a disaster for everyone.
Why would having a socialist economy stop recessions?
A socialist economy is built, as I said, around these worker cooperatives, or this is how I would say, ask me to build a socialist economy, this is how I do it.
And collective farms. What, sorry?
It's built around worker cooperatives. These cooperatives
extremely
are
inefficient.
The same efficiency as investor owned banks. Well, 1%.
What about other businesses?
Right, well, hear him out. Hear him out, man.
I mean, they're
we'll talk about other businesses after, but yeah.
They're less like, they're more stable, they're less likely to fail, their workers are generally paid better, and because they're democratically controlled and owned, it allows for these to work in like in a slightly different way to a way you have a business. And I think these are poor examples, actually. I think you could get much better than this, because these have to operate in a capitalist system. They are restricted by the fact that they have to make profit in a capitalist system, which sort of profit... Okay, I'm going to get some looks here. But profit is making money off other people. If you make profit, you are taking money from other people.
But you're providing a service for money, so you just exchanged it, basically.
No. That's profit, right? If you own if you own something making spanners, and you are selling spanners and making profit for shareholders, that profit is value that has been added by your work, yes, your work by yourself, but also the work of your workers. That is the value that's been added. Any money that goes to shareholders is money that actually was produced by the work. The value was added by the workers.
Have initially, shareholders, they earn a stake in a company by spending money on it. They earn a stake in the company by investing in it, allowing the company to invest and increase efficiency to make greater profits.
But isn't that developing the wealth inequality gap? So because if you can afford shares, then the value of the shares rise, you sell those shares, buy new shares, okay? All while, as we mentioned at the start, a small number of people have a lot of shares, okay? That small number of people is getting richer and richer because they can trade on the stock markets, on the FTSE, on the NASDAQ, on the New York Stock Exchange, while the rest of the world's population can't. And they get richer, but at a slower rate compared to the rest of the rich, true, which is why the rich get... So you have the phrase, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. True, but misleading. Yep. So actually, both the rich and the poor are getting richer, but the poor are getting richer less quick. Therefore, they're technically getting poorer.
And at the moment, increasingly less quick. That is the way the trend lines are going. And the basics of it are that in a socialist economy, you don't need capital to make money. You just need to work.
You what?
In a capitalist economy, the more capital you have, the more money you make. Like, those are two things that are just related.
Yeah, well, more facts of production you have, the more money you make.
Did you say facts of production?
Factors of production.
Oh, factors of production.
So labour. So the more workers you have, the more money you make as well.
So the facts of production are, for those who don't do economics A-level...
or have common sense.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
sure. No, actually,
labour, capital, which in this case we'll talk about as machinery...
Enterprise. That's like money and organisation.
Yes, that's investment and...
And land. Is natural resources.
I forgot two of the factors. That's the first thing you learn in lesson one. And I've forgotten two of them. Sorry. So that's the factors of production. So the more factors of production you have, the more productive
you are.
The more
and the better quality you have, the more production you are,
get
the more money you make.
More money.
Not necessarily. It means you can produce more. But obviously you have diseconomies of scale. But yeah. I think that's not really relevant to this point.
back to the point.
Basically, I assume that growth, as in like internal growth rate and external growth rate of cooperative-based companies. So I think, I'm going to move away from banks, because banks are a special case. A bank does not work the same way as a normal business works. But so a growth rate of a cooperatively owned business will be lower than of a privately owned business. And so they're less likely to benefit from economies of scale, less likely to be able to produce things at a lower cost, less likely to be able to grow, provide lower prices, and lead to, you know, higher standard of living in the economy.
So why would socialism be any more productive? So cooperatives, why
are
they...
Socialist productions are going to be less efficient than capitalist productions, because they're not motivated by profit.
So I have no idea whether you're right on the efficiency or not. Like, I can't see the numbers. Because for banks, you were wrong, but for this, I don't know. But where I'd say is, it does this, okay, right, sure, growth is lower, but all of that growth is going back to the workers. If there's 1% growth, that is distributed among the workers, by the workers, for the workers. It is not squirreled away into tax havens. It's not given to shareholders who all they have done is put buy shares because they already have money. Every single benefit to this economy directly benefits the people who work, like you and me. There's this misunderstanding that in these economies, the middle classes suffer. No, they don't. They benefit from their own work like everyone else. It's only the rich shareholders who contribute nothing but make all the money. They suffer.
And that concludes Will's bid for Prime Minister as the head of the Labour Party. It's now time for us to finish. Sorry, Matt.
No, I had a good point to make there, but I forgot it because Will's monologues for so long that I didn't get my points.
You see, you were
getting a little bit rosy-cheeked, you know, there's a few tears in the room, sort of, socialist vision. But at the end of the day, it was just a bit of codswallop. So, let's sum up each of us with our final points. We've had a lot of noise, not a huge amount of substance today, but we'll see if anything has changed. Final viewpoint, please, gentlemen.
So, I haven't changed my opinion. I don't think anyone's ever changed their opinion on this podcast, actually. I'm still in favour of capitalism. I think that morally, socialism may be better. However, practically, it does not work. There's never been an example of it working properly. There's human characteristics and human nature, like greed, which just means that it can't work. And so capitalism is the most realistic way to achieve growth that will benefit the most number of people.
Okay, Will.
Socialism is the best way to run an economy, it's the most moral way to run an economy, and it's probably the only one that won't destroy the world through global warming, so there's also that.
Peter?
I mean, I guess Will's kind of right, but not as much. So I'm going to end with a Karl Marx quote, because he's not extreme. last words are for fools who haven't said enough.
And on that note, we end the podcast. Goodbye.
Follow us on Instagram @podcastpoorly
and Twitter at the same place, I think.